Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tracking a nearly two-century institutional effort to, well, to manage and rewrite its own racially charged history.
That's right. We're looking at how a single foundational scripture, the Skin of Blackness curse from the Book of Mormon, was slowly, and you could say stealthily, dismantled.
And not because of some internal revelation, but because of pressure from science and, you know, a shifting social conscience.
Exactly. Our sources for this deep dive are a whole collection of historical documents, sermons from prophets, official church manuals, even edits to the scriptures themselves.
So the mission here is critical. We're analyzing how a major religious institution shifts its interpretation over time.
It's a journey from these very literal biological claims about race to much more modern, nuanced, and often contradictory explanations.
This isn't just history. It's really an autopsy of narrative control. We're tracking the shift from that original belief that dark skin was a literal marker of wickedness
to the modern attempts to just move the goalposts.
Right. Today you might hear that the dark mark meant something like tattoos or body paint, maybe even animal coats. But you have to ask yourself,
does that really sound like a theory that justifies 150 years of institutional practice?
It doesn't seem to line up. So let's hold the historical record accountable. We have to start at the foundation, right? The 19th century context where this belief was completely unambiguous.
It was. When Joseph Smith and the early leaders talked about this curse, they were explicitly linking dark skin to the Lamanites, who they identified as Native Americans and indigenous peoples.
The message was just direct.
Incredibly direct. Skin means skin, and dark means dark. There's no metaphor there.
And the implications of this literal color-based curse were put into practice almost immediately. I mean, the statements from Brigham Young are just stunningly clear on this.
They are. In 1851, he advised the saints to, and this is a quote, buy up the Lamanite children as fast as they could to educate them.
Buy up the children. He's not talking about metaphorical redemption.
No, not at all. He was talking about a biological, generational change that he believed would happen from being exposed to the gospel. He actually predicted that not many generations would pass ere they would become a white and delightsome people.
That phrase, buy up the children, it's a direct reference to human trafficking. The justification for colonizing and re-educating Native American children was framed as this divine path to their physical and color-based redemption.
It weaponized children against their own supposed curse. And this wasn't just some one-off thought. It was policy.
So he doubles down on it.
He does. In 1852, he's instructing saints on intermarriage with Native Americans. He says, "We will have intermarriages with them. By these means, it is the will of the Lord that the curse of their color shall be removed and they restored to their pristine beauty."
So he's explicitly linking a biological change, the removal of a color curse, to worthiness and intermarriage.
Precisely. The ultimate goal was literal skin lightening through living the gospel and eventually through genetic mixing.
And he didn't stop there, did he?
No. By 1854, he's describing the Lamanites as having sunk into wickedness and evil principles, the most degrading, and have become loathsome and vile.
You know, what's crucial here, and it's a common point of confusion, is that the racism aimed at the Lamanites, at Native Americans, was different from the priesthood ban against people of African descent.
Right, but both were based on a curse narrative.
Hmm.
The key difference was that the Lamanite curse was considered redeemable.
So one curse could be lightened over time, but the other could not.
Exactly. Wilford Woodruff even said the curse would be removed from the Lamanites before it was removed from the children of Judah. It really sets up this hierarchy of racial curses, all rooted in scripture.
It's just astonishing that this belief survived for 150 years. But something had to give. This literal narrative, it didn't just fade away with the 19th century.
Well, it powered massive institutional programs for decades. We absolutely have to talk about Spencer W. Kimball. He was an apostle, later the prophet, and he saw himself as the champion for the Lamanites.
And he really believed in their physical, color-based redemption, didn't he?
He had a deep personal conviction that it was imminent, and his vision led directly to the Indian Student Placement Program, the ISPP, which ran from 1954 all the way to 2000.
Give us a sense of the scale here.
It was massive. Around 50,000 Native American children participated. They were hosted by predominantly white families, and the whole ideological justification for it was this unwavering belief that these children, as Lamanite descendants, would undergo a physical transformation.
A physical one. The idea that righteousness actually changes your skin color is horrific, and the language Kimball used is so jarring.
It is. In a 1960 writing, he claimed that the kids in the ISPP were physically growing delightsome, and they are now becoming white and delightsome. That is not a spiritual metaphor.
No, that's a physical claim. And he even tried to offer scientific proof.
He did. Yeah. He told this story about a 16-year-old girl in the program who he said was several shades lighter than her parents on the same reservation, in the same hogan, subject to the same sun and wind and weather.
Wait, so he's pointing to the fact that she was in the same environment, but because she was in the placement program living the gospel, she was literally physically lighter.
Correct. That quote is the smoking gun. It's a prophet attributing a visible biological color change directly to righteousness. It's a complete validation of that original 19th century belief.
And this belief even bled into, well, into jokes.
Yeah, Kimball recalled a white elder joking about donating blood to a hospital in the hope that the process might be accelerated.
Wow.
It shows you just how pervasive the idea of biological blood level change was. It wasn't some arcane doctrine. It was part of the culture.
And it was institutionally reinforced everywhere. The official literature pushed this.
Absolutely. The 1974 missionary pamphlet, which was used worldwide, told Native Americans, quote, "The Lamanites were marked by the Lord with a darker skin."
And the children's books, too.
Even the kids' literature. The 1978 Book of Mormon Stories Reader depicted Lamanites as a dark-skinned people who became lazy, and it contrasted them with the righteous white Nephites. Children were taught this for two decades.
So the belief was literal, official, and just embedded everywhere. But a system built on physical transformation is so vulnerable to scientific challenge.
Extremely.
And that brings us to the pivot point, right? The crisis of the 2000s. What was the external pressure that finally became too great to ignore?
In a word, genetics. In the early 2000s, geneticists started publishing robust findings that just completely challenged the Book of Mormon's claims about Native American ancestry. The DNA simply did not line up.
Can you give us the specifics on that research?
Sure. In 2002, an anthropologist, Thomas Murphy, published findings showing DNA evidence overwhelmingly linked Native Americans to Asian populations through the Bering Strait, not to ancient Israelites.
Okay, and then there was another big one.
Yeah, in 2004, Simon Sennington, who was a faithful Mormon bishop at the time, published his book, Losing a Lost Tribe. It just thoroughly laid out all the genetic evidence that contradicted the Book of Mormon's origin story for the indigenous peoples of the Americas.
So you have these members, academics, using science to challenge a core, racially charged doctrine. What was the response to them?
Well, think about the stakes. A faithful bishop challenges doctrine with verifiable facts, and the consequence for Southerton is excommunication. Murphy just barely avoided it. The facts were dangerous.
But the church couldn't just ignore them.
They couldn't. So the larger public response was this classic, quiet exercise in narrative control. It was a stealth edit to the scripture itself.
A single word change to the introduction of the Book of Mormon. What did the original 1981 intro say?
That intro, written by Apostle Bruce R. McConkie, stated that the Lamanites are the principal ancestors of the American Indians. A very bold, specific claim.
Principal ancestors, meaning the majority of their genetic makeup.
Exactly. And that claim was just scientifically indefensible after 2004. So the text was changed. Quietly at first in 2007, then officially in print by 2013. It now states that the Lamanites are among the ancestors of the American Indians.
Wait, one word, from principal to among. And was this change announced?
Virtually unannounced. It took researchers tracking printing history to even confirm the shift. It was a strategic surgical retreat from a historical claim that had become a major liability.
And that retreat, that's what opened the door for modern apologetics, for trying to defend the scripture without all the historical baggage.
That's where you get the claims that skin of blackness meant paint or tattoos or animal skins, anything but literal skin.
And this is where the historical context becomes, as you said, the wrecking ball. The question isn't whether paint is possible, but can that theory be reconciled with 150 years of prophetic teaching?
It can't. If you accept the facts we just laid out, the need for intermarriage, the observation of kids becoming several shades lighter, what does the paint theory try to sanitize?
The entire Indian student placement program.
The whole thing. If the mark was just cultural paint or a coat, why did prophets authorize a 46-year program built on the idea that exposure to white culture and intermarriage would biologically reverse the curse?
Right. If the mark was just paint, you wouldn't need the Lord to remove it.
You'd need water. The dissonance between the modern theory and the prophetic action is just immense.
You really can't divorce the modern, softer interpretation from the decades of institutional actions it was justifying. And that brings us to today. How does the church manage this contradiction now?
Well, we saw an incredible example of institutional hedging in the 2020 Come Follow Me manual. They quoted Joseph Fielding Smith's from 1960, but they used ellipses to surgically remove the most damaging phrases.
What specifically did they take out?
They deleted the reference to Lamanites becoming loathsome and filthy. But crucially, they also removed the qualifier that the dark skin was no longer to be considered a sign of the curse, only for those who have come into the church.
So by taking that second part out, they made it sound like the prophet was disavowing the curse entirely.
When in reality, he was only offering conditional relief to baptized members. It's a calculated effort to create a sanitized narrative for today's members without ever officially challenging a past prophet's authority.
It's rhetorical gymnastics.
It is. And this ambiguity has become the official position. The current online interpretation of the curse is that the nature and appearance of this mark are not fully understood.
And that's just a stunning statement.
It is. An institution that claims divine guidance says it can't interpret its own core racially charged scripture. That ambiguity is the space that allows apologetic theories like paint and tattoos to survive, because the leadership doesn't have to take responsibility for the history.
Yet the dissonance still persists visually. You see it in their illustrations today.
Oh, absolutely. The 2024 Come Follow Me manual, which guides the entire church, still has illustrations of battle scenes where the Lamanites are clearly depicted as dark-skinned, Native American-looking individuals fighting against lighter-skinned Nephites. The visual shorthand of the curse is still there.
So what this deep dive really reveals is a very careful, calculated strategy of narrative control.
Yes. They're quietly retreating from 150 years of explicit, literal racism linked to skin color. But they're refusing to issue a formal disavowal or an apology for the prophetic teachings that justified it.
The institution is forcing the current generation to forget the explicit actions of the past, all while preserving the infallibility of those past leaders.
The goal is to make the embarrassing statements irrelevant without ever saying they were wrong.
And for you, the listener, this raises a huge question about reliability and authority. When an institution strategically alters its core tenets because of external pressure, like DNA or social values, you have to ask, where does the true authority reside?
If past prophets were so demonstrably wrong on a biological matter of this magnitude, why should we trust the contemporary leaders? The cost of that ambiguity is immense.
The curse of the skin of blackness might be less about the Lamanites' original wickedness and more about the institution's unwillingness to confront its own racist origins. So you have to ask, what does that perpetual state of rhetorical hedging cost the people, particularly the indigenous communities, who were told for generations that this text was their actual, literal, and damning history? That is the lingering debt of historical narrative control.